Our next case is 10-1335, the American Chemical Society versus Leadscope Incorporated et al. For the appellant, we have Mr. DeBruin.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, my name is David DeBruin. I represent the American Chemical Society and Chemical Abstracts Service. The court has granted our motion for divided argument, and the state of Ohio will take 2 minutes today. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. ACS brought legal claims to the courts of Ohio that had a substantial basis in law and fact, and neither court below ever suggested otherwise. There could not be an instance further removed from sham litigation. Only one defendant moved for summary judgment. That motion was denied. ACS presented substantial evidence at trial through 15 witnesses, including two renowned experts. Its claims were found sufficient to reach the jury, and in fact, the jury verdict ruling against ACS on its claims was not unanimous. But for bringing its claims to the state of Ohio and for making two simple statements of counsel about those claims, ACS has been found liable for more than $35 million in damages.
Counsel, didn't ACS accuse these people of stealing their work product?
Your Honor, that was the essence of the legal claim ACS brought to the courts.
And they didn't move on this until these folks got a patent. Now, I don't know much about patent law, but isn't there an opportunity when someone seeks a patent for someone else who claims that they've essentially stolen it from them?
Your Honor, the evidence was
To present that to the patent authorities and dispute the right to get the patent in the first place.
Your Honor, this was a claim based on misappropriation of trade secrets because the defendants in the action had worked for Chemical Abstracts.
Well, they had worked for other people too, hadn't they?
Well, they had worked for Chemical Abstracts, and while they were at Chemical Abstracts, they had developed a software product that the Court of Appeals in this case recognized was a comparable product. And the defendants then left to form their own company with the express intent.
Again, okay, but my question isn't there an opportunity to dispute this with the Patent Office?
Well, the claim here was not, ACS did not claim it had a patent that the defendants had violated ACS's patent.
But if it claims that they took their data and were essentially taking what they had developed at ACS and went to the Patent Office and are trying to get a patent, wouldn't there be a mechanism for disputing that with the Patent Office?
Your Honor, there may have been other avenues that could have been pursued. The point is they came to the courts of Ohio with a legitimate claim that had a substantial basis in law. In fact, in neither court below found that this was sham litigation, that the claims lacked a basis. The courts instead found that there was malicious litigation based solely on a subjective intent to harm a competitor. And that is where the Court of Appeals, I submit, erred. There has never been an instance where, in the courts of Ohio, malicious litigation has been found strictly on a subjective intent. Rather, there has been a requirement that the claim must lack warrant or proof. It must lack a basis. That, in fact,
well,
is.
Well, the AG is arguing there is no such claim and shouldn't be recognized in Ohio.
Well,
but if that were the case, then your client should have moved for a 12B6 dismissal of the counterclaim to begin with.
Well, NACS did, in fact, move for a dismissal of this count at the beginning. It moved to dismiss, and that motion was denied. And significantly, it moved for a directed verdict at the close of the case, and it specifically argued we were entitled to bring our claims. Our claims are supported by substantial evidence. It made basically the same argument that is set forth by this court in Greer Burger and in other cases, that parties have a right to petition the courts. They have a right to come forward. And that's what ACS counsel argued in for a directed verdict. Your Honor, we were entitled to bring these claims. They were supported
by
substantial evidence.
So what did the jury ultimately award? What can you parse the verdict for us? Because it wasn't all for one item.
That is correct, Your Honor. The jury ultimately awarded $15 million for defamation based on the two statements of counsel, and that was 13.75 in compensatory damages and 1.25 million in punitive damages. It awarded 8.5 million for unfair competition based on malicious litigation and false and disparaging statements. Again, that was $4 million in compensatory, another $4.5 million in punitives, and then another $3 million for tortious interference. So it was parsed out. But each of the defendants' counterclaims was based on the same theory, which is that ACS had acted wrongly in bringing claims to the courts
of
Ohio.
Well, the defamation is a separate claim, is it not?
It is a separate claim, and we have...
So the jury made a determination your client lost. What's our basis for reversing that part of it?
The basis for reversing, Your Honor, is that the decision below is based on clear legal errors that we asked this court to review. Specifically, there is no legal claim for malicious litigation based solely on subjective bad faith.
But that wasn't the defamation claim. Judge Bryan analyzes that. It was two or three things. And
yes,
are you asking us to determine the jury was wrong in determining those two or three things?
No. What we're contending is that the court below applied the wrong legal standard, both as to malicious litigation and as to defamation. On defamation, we make two principal claims set forth in our proposition of law. And that specifically, what we contend is two things. One, when an attorney makes a limited statement that merely identifies the allegations in a lawsuit, that statement is not defamatory as a matter of law, and there is no basis for a finding of actual malice. Those are both legal propositions that I submit this court should consider.
Well,
what the court below...
Counsel, even if there was animosity and bad blood and ugliness between the parties, that alone is not going to bear on the validity of the lawsuit. And it seems to me that there was maybe an over-reliance on the motivation for the lawsuit in this case. There was an emphasis here that I don't know was appropriately placed. I'm more concerned, though, about the fact that the standard in Greerberger was not even mentioned in the appellate opinion and was simply discarded. The ability to to declare that the action is objectively baseless is, I think, what you're arguing should have been the standard, and the instructions follow along that line of legal thought. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And that, again, is...
Was that argued at the time of instruction?
Yes, it was. It was argued in two ways, Your Honor. First, ACS counsel argued for a directed verdict using the words, Your Honor, we were entitled to bring this lawsuit. This lawsuit was supported by substantial evidence. That is, again, the same objectively baseless standard. He is saying we're entitled. We have a right to bring this lawsuit because it's supported by substantial evidence. That's one. Secondly, ACS specifically sought an instruction at trial that would have defined a claim not founded in good faith as specifically a claim that lacked probable cause, meaning that the claim had no merit. So we sought an instruction that, again, incorporated the constitutional standard that you could only find liability for pursuit of a lawsuit if that lawsuit was a sham, if it lacked probable cause. And that's what the Supreme Court in the PRE case specifically said, that sham litigation is litigation that lacks probable cause, a standard that this court is very familiar with, courts across the land are very familiar with. It is baseless. It lacks a foundation. It is objectively baseless. Now, that is what ACS argued, both in seeking a directed verdict and in the instruction it sought. Instead, the trial court refused that request, and it said to the jury, you can find malicious litigation strictly based upon a subjective intent to injure a competitor. And then the Court of Appeals upheld that standard as a basis for malicious litigation. And when it got to defamation, it applied the same standard of malice in basically upholding the jury's finding of actual malice. It found in paragraph 61 of the Court of Appeals decision that actual malice could be inferred from the evidence that ACS brought this suit to harm a competitor. But
And you don't... Your position is to win. You don't have to dispute that's what your client was up to. They wanted to crush this new business.
Justice Pfeiffer, we absolutely dispute that, but it's not the issue for this court. We vigorously disputed that evidence at trial. We admit we lost that factual dispute. But the issue is not whether or not there was that evidence. The issue now is whether that evidence of subjective intent to harm a competitor is enough to create liability both for defamation and for malicious litigation. The Supreme Court recognized in PRE that whenever you have litigation between two businesses, between two competitors, there obviously is going to be a desire to injure the other party. ACS believed that LeadScope had inappropriately taken ACS's intellectual property. It did seek to stop that unfair competition. Of course, there was a subjective intent to harm a competitor. But the legal issue is, did ACS's claims have a substantial basis? That's the same standard for any litigant, whether a large litigant or a small litigant. When you come to the courts, do you have a basis to bring your claims? That's what this court in the Robb case, in the context of malicious prosecution, made clear, that you cannot have a claim of malicious prosecution unless the claim lacks probable cause, and further, that there's a seizure of property or the person. And the reason for that is, the court said, is we don't want to encourage that every time there is a lawsuit brought, there will be counterclaims for malicious prosecution or other similar theories, making litigation expensive and burdensome. As the court noted in Robb, there are many opportunities within the legal system to deal with frivolous lawsuits. There's Rule 12, there's Rule 11, there's the sanctions for attorney's fees provisions under Ohio law. We don't need to create new theories of counterclaim liability that whenever anybody sues, if that party loses, they're going to be at risk of malicious prosecution, malicious litigation,
counsel,
defamation.
Counsel, let me bring you back to something that's I'm concerned with in the Court of Appeals decision. And the statement is, Ohio courts considering comparable malicious litigation claims have not applied the objectively baseless standard.
And, Your Honor, I would submit that is incorrect. The court relied on Gehring for that proposition. What the court in Gehring said is that the allegation in the case was that the claims that were brought lacked, quote, no warrant or proof. They lacked an objective foundation. And that's what Gehring said. As the state will argue, and I want to preserve time to the state, Gehring was decided on a motion to dismiss. The case later went off on other grounds. The authority for even the tort as recognized in Gehring is very limited. I submit the court should not adopt it. But in any event, if the court would recognize the theory, it requires that the claim be objectively baseless.
Counsel, the malicious litigation claim that you're talking about was not actually put to the jury in that way. It was the defamation and the unfair competition. If you were to take, in your view, if you were to take the evidence of the malicious litigation out, would there be sufficient evidence there for the defamation and the unfair competition?
No, Your Honor, because even under defamation, you must both prove that the statements are defamatory and that there's actual malice. There's no finding for actual malice here. I'd refer to the Veronese case and the syllabus of this court, paragraph 1, that makes clear that malice cannot be inferred based on an intent to harm. That's paragraph 1 of the syllabus. In addition, the theories of unfair competition were merged. That was one cause of action. There was clearly prejudice from the malicious litigation theory that was improperly instructed to the jury.
So you're saying that it infected the entire trial?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Let me reserve my time for the state.
You've reserved a minute and 24 seconds.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The state of Ohio has no interest in the specifics of this dispute. Our concern implicates one threshold legal issue, one that is fundamental to the fairness and efficacy of civil litigation in Ohio. The 10th District below recognized a tort of malicious litigation. First, that tort does not exist in Ohio, and second, there is no reason for it to exist. The malicious litigation tort is not found in any of this court's common law decisions discussing tort liability. It's not found in the restatement. It's not found in any of the leading treatises on tort law. The 10th District relied entirely on the Gehring case out of the 8th District.
Counsel, you're here to tell us this is a new tort and we shouldn't have it. But you're representing the state of Ohio, who I believe has given some tax breaks and other incentives to this new small business. This litigation is about a big business who tried to put out of business a new upstart business. I thought, you know, Ohio, we were trying to encourage new ideas and new upstart businesses. I can't understand why the state wants to get in the middle of a fight between two businesses, one large and one small. Why are you here? I just don't understand that.
The state's concern here is the same concern that this court identified in the Crawford decision. In Crawford, the court made clear that it is not hard to imagine scenarios where potential litigants, litigants of limited means, are deterred from utilizing the courts of Ohio out of fear of reprisals via counterclaims.
So you're here to encourage litigation between businesses?
Not at all, Your Honor. The concern identified in Crawford was that plaintiffs of all stripes will be inhibited from walking into the courthouse door out of a fear that the defendant will hit them with a counterclaim. And that runs right up against the Ohio Constitution's right of access to courts provisions. It runs right up into this court's decision in Robb. On page 70, the court made very clear that it's going to leave to the rules of civil procedure and the General Assembly.
Do you think that the defendant could not have filed a defamation claim as a counterclaim in this lawsuit?
The defamation claim, Your Honor? The state of Ohio has concerns about the defamation claim for the reasons our
question is, since you're so concerned about counterclaims or the fear of filing a lawsuit because of a counterclaim, and because you argue that malicious litigation is not or should not be a recognized tort in Ohio, do you agree that the defendant could have filed a defamation claim as a counterclaim?
Yes, Your Honor. The state's main concern in this case is the tort of malicious litigation. Throughout 150 years in this state, no appellate court has ever affirmed a jury award for malicious litigation.
Counsel, you're basically saying that we're coming dangerously close to a loser pays type of a situation?
Exactly. The tort, as identified by the 10th District, as best as I can tell, contains one element, bad faith by the plaintiff in bringing the claim. Every defendant in every civil case is going to legitimately feel that way. So civil litigation is contentious. They're going to file counterclaims, and then we're going to run up against this court's fear in Crawford about deterring potential plaintiffs, as well as this court's statement in Robb that it is not going to recognize or expand common law.
Well, but I thought the appellant was arguing that this wasn't a proof of bad faith.
The parties here are wrangling over the elements of this tort. The state is here on the threshold legal issue. Does this tort exist at common law in Ohio?
I guess the question I have is, if I understood Mr. De Bruin's argument, the verdicts are for defamation, unfair competition, and not malicious litigation. It may all be bundled under a title, but the actual verdicts didn't relate to malicious litigation. It may have been propounded out of malice, but it came through a tort that is recognized in Ohio.
Your Honor, I am not aware of any, well, first of all, the entire basis of the unfair competition claim, I'm recalling the record correctly, was the malicious litigation theory. And I'm not aware of any case law in Ohio endorsing that theory.
Well,
I
think our question is that what they called it, or is that a new catchy name that the appellants and the Attorney General have come up with to package this appeal in a way that gathers our attention?
Not at all, Your Honor. The 10th District said in paragraph.
Was that pled malicious litigation?
Yes, that was the theory of the unfair competition tort. And that theory has never been accepted in Ohio.
The Court of Appeals says, Henry Gehring, the seminal Ohio case adopting malicious litigation as a basis for the tort of unfair competition explains or explicitly applies bad faith standard, concluding, et cetera, et cetera. So this is not a term that you have come up with. This is something that the 10th District is recognizing.
Exactly, Your Honor. And if one reads the complaint in Gehring, the trial transcripts in Gehring, as well as the jury instructions in Gehring, all of which are available on the 11th floor of the courthouse, all of those documents belie any notion that the 8th District back in 1926 was somehow recognizing, adopting, or endorsing malicious litigation as a basis for an unfair competition tort. Okay. It doesn't exist, and for that reason, we ask that you reverse. Thank you.
Mr. Briggs.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, my name is Alan Briggs. I have 3 points I would like to discuss in a brief close, but let me respond to a couple of questions that were earlier addressed, asked by this court. Justice Pfeiffer asked, I believe, if there were any remedies that would have been available with regard to the patent issue, and there was trial testimony on this. Yes, there was a remedy at the patent office for a reexamination, and that was not pursued by the American Chemical Society.
But does our tort system require a defendant or a plaintiff to choose a particular remedy because that is a remedy you would prefer, or are they allowed free access to the court to pick the remedy of going after unfair competition or trade secrets? I mean, you're basically saying they should have gone the patent route, and that's...
No, I'm not suggesting they should have, Your Honor, or they shouldn't have. I'm merely responding to the question, and that is, His Honor asked with regard to that, and there was testimony. There is a remedy that, one, they could have filed for re-exam. Two, they could have filed in federal court challenging inventorship.
And is your position that the failure to do those two remedies is an evidence of bad faith? Is that
I'm not suggesting that at all, Your Honor. I'm only responding to the question.
Okay.
A second question that was asked, and that was by Chief Justice O'Connor, and that was with regard to the objective baselessness standard. This is a very important question. You ask as to whether or not this was raised at the jury stage of the trial of the case, and it was not. It is absolutely clear that this objective baselessness standard, the Knorr-Pennington doctrine, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, this is all the same. It's referred to as the Knorr-Pennington doctrine and has been for 50 years. This was never, ever raised by the American Chemical Society at any time in the 5.5 years leading up to trial or in the 8 weeks of trial. They never raised it. The first
they
time
they never raised the objective standard.
That is correct. They never raised it. They never cited the court to the right to petition, the Knorr-Pennington doctrine, or anything like that. Absolutely, every representation they make to the contrary is not accurate.
But what was the basis then of their motion for directed verdict and 12B6? They said we have a right to bring the suit. What do you call that?
The first, in the 12B6, they made no statement like that. It was purely on an absolute privilege. On the motion, the Rule 50 motion for a directed verdict, they made 11 separate motions. None of them dealt with this whatsoever. The only thing he said, and that is, well, we had a lot of evidence to support our case. Everybody argues that. They always say they had a lot of evidence to support their case.
That's not a denial of objective basis? I mean, we say I have a lot of evidence.
No.
That's saying I have a basis.
No, that isn't. That in all due respect, Your Honor, that is not what was said. The Knorr-Pennington Doctrine is, in this country, an affirmative defense. The law is absolutely clear it's an affirmative defense. Because they suggested it wasn't, in their reply brief, I filed supplemental authority. And in that supplemental authority, I invite your attention to the Baldo case decided by the West Virginia Supreme Court in March of this year. In that case, they reviewed the Knorr-Pennington Doctrine and the history of it and said, it is an affirmative defense. It must be raised. If it's not raised, it's waived. Here, it was not raised in any way, shape, or form. They say, as I say, Judge Stratton, there were 11 Justice Stratton, there were 11 separate motions they made at Rule 50 stage. None of them dealt with this at all. And then at the jury instruction stage, they say they used a instruction that had probable cause. Well, that is true. They did put a probable cause language in an instruction, but the basis for that was they told the judge that, well, this relates to malicious prosecution. And the judge, of course, says this isn't a malicious prosecution claim, therefore that wouldn't apply. Now, at this court, they say, well, because we had probable cause language in there, that gets us the right to the Nora Pennington doctrine. And that's not the case. That's not the argument they made at trial. I invite you to the your attention to the decision of your court in the Lieber versus Smith case, 70 Ohio State 3rd, 548, in 1994, in which Justice Pfeiffer dealt with this, speaking for the court, this exact issue, and stated, because Buckeye Union's reason for objecting to the jury instruction is not the same as its reason for objecting at trial, Buckeye Union was precluded from arguing on appeal that this instruction was improper. That is exactly the law that applies here. That is exactly what they are doing. At the trial, they made no objection whatsoever based on Nora Pennington, objective baselessness, or anything at all related to that. New counsel for the American Chemical Society comes in and says that, well, that is something the trial counsel at the time made. But that is not. All the records there, we've put everything in there in the supplement for you to consider. So number one, the point is, the Nora Pennington doctrine, the affirmative defense, was waived. It was never brought up. No court in this country has ever permitted a party to first raise the Nora Pennington defense after the trial was over, 2 months after the trial was over the first time it ever came up. Now let me address the second issue, and that is the unfair competition claim. The law in Ohio, in this case, there was substantial evidence with regard to unfair competition. The tort, as the court has stated, was unfair competition. And there's two types of unfair competition that were dealt with. One is malicious litigation. Two is are false rumors and statements, all false disparagement, all designed to harm a competitor. Those are two separate torts, ways that unfair competition can be proved. Either one of those will result in unfair competition, and both were alleged here. And there was evidence with regard to both. There was a jury instruction on both, and there was one general verdict with regard to unfair competition and one damage award. The American Chemical Society here challenges the malicious litigation issue. They don't challenge the rumors and disparagement. There's no question the instruction on that was proper. They make no challenge to that. And they did not have a jury interrogatory to inquire as to the verdict, as to how it was split. The jury came back and specifically found that both of these were present. The tort was proved by malicious litigation. The tort was proved by virtue of disparagement and rumors.
Counsel, did they request an interrogatory to split these out that was refused by Judge Reese?
No, they did not ask, and it was not refused. They did not ask for an interrogatory, Your Honor, and therefore the two-issue rule obviously would apply if either one were wrong. But neither one was wrong. The instruction on malicious litigation as part of unfair competition is exactly what the Ohio law is. And while the state of Ohio comes in now and says, well, there is no such tort, that's not what the American Chemical Society said at trial. Trial counsel, sitting right there, stood up in front of the court and said, yes, there is this tort. These are the elements. They are the same elements that were instructed, that the trial court instructed the jury on. There wasn't any question on that. And they acknowledged the tort exists. There wasn't any question with regard to it. Now the state comes in and says something different. I don't think that's what this court has said an amicus curiae can do, but regardless, The law in Ohio is very clear and has been clear. Unfair competition by malicious litigation is there. In 1926, the Court of Appeals in Cuyahoga County said it in the Guerin case.
Counsel, let me just stop you for a minute. Am I correct in being under the impression that it was counsel that made the statements, not the parties?
There were two statements, two defamatory statements. One was made on May 10th of 2002. That was made by counsel.
That was the longer statement reiterating pretty much their theory of the case.
That was made to the press.
I know, but was it after the filing of the complaint?
Yes, Your Honor.
So
ten days after.
Everything that he said was contained in the complaint.
Some of it was. Some of it wasn't. That which was false was not in the complaint. It was there. It was a false statement. And
what statement was that?
That was the statement that the lawsuit was filed to recover back information, confidential information, protected information that they took from us. The reason why they filed it, that wasn't in the complaint, and the fact that they took back information, that was a false statement. And there were allegations with regard to similar type allegations in the complaint. But at that time, a statement to the press was a conditionally privileged statement. Lawyers are not free to make any statement they choose.
Well, then why is the party being punished for the lawyer statement, or is the lawyer sanctioned here with that amount of damages?
There was testimony at trial with regard to the American Chemical Society authorized that statement to be made. The statement was a statement of the American Chemical Society made by its counsel. And the testimony was that was an authorized statement to be made. And therefore, they are held responsible as an agent making their statement. But they didn't question the authority. That was not an issue. But the unfair competition.
Is your whole basis for malicious litigation, whether or not counsel claimed it at trial or not, doesn't matter because whether we have to decide what the law of Ohio is. Is your whole basis Guerin?
No. No, Your Honor. As I was indicating, Guerin in 1926, in 1984, this court said exactly the same thing in the water management case. In 1986,
we called it malicious litigation?
Yes. Those were the exact words that were used, Your Honor. Exactly the same words of Guerin. And then in 1986, the Court of Appeals of Medina County said exactly the same thing. There was the jury instruction that was used in the Harco case in 1986. And there was malicious litigation, and there were two types of malicious litigation, but it was unfair competition, malicious litigation, and disparaging statements. There, the court as well, and the jury instruction that was used in this case by Judge Reese was the exact same jury instruction. It was a perfect statement of what the law in Ohio is. And the jury and the court in Harco, the Court of Appeals in Harco, indicated the two-issue rule applied, and either one of those would have been satisfactory. In addition, legal scholars in Ohio in 1995 in the Ohio Northern Law Review, there's an extensive law review article, and I cite that again in the supplemental authorities that have reviewed the law and this tort. In 2001, the federal court in the Northern District of Ohio in the Microsoft case acknowledged the tort. In 2011, in March of this year, in the Southern District of Ohio, they also reviewed the law very carefully in Ohio and acknowledged that exact tort exists. There isn't any question it is here, and it was acknowledged, as I say, by the American Chemical Society. And at the Court of Appeals, the American Chemical Society said the Guerin case was the seminal case. So it is the law.
Where would you put the Greerberger case, your analysis?
The Greerberger case is a statement of the objective baselessness standard, and that was used to establish a standard for the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. It's a reasonable standard for determine whether or not to find probable cause as to whether or not to send it back whether or not there should be a trial in that particular case. It was a sexual harassment case, so it was an appropriate standard. Objective baselessness and the professional case, the professional case is of the United States Supreme Court. That's all good law. There isn't any question about that. That is the Knorr-Pennington standard that if a party wishes to challenge a lawsuit or a claim and say that violates my right to petition the government, they can. That's appropriate, just like it would be for unfair competition. If someone wants to assert an affirmative defense, that's what the Rule 8 of the Ohio Rules of Civil Procedure say. If you have an affirmative defense or avoidance matter, you assert affirmative defense, and then it gets considered. They never did that.
The rule also says if you don't, it's waived, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your yellow light's on. You said you had 3 points you wanted to make. I think we got two of them. Well, or maybe you've made all three.
Correct, Your Honor. The third point, thank you. The third point is with regard to the May 1st statement to the all staff. They make the claim that they should be entitled to the absolute privilege for that statement. But at trial, again, the American Chemical Society never, ever asked that absolute privilege be given to that statement. They only asked for a qualified privilege. We opposed it. We didn't think it was appropriate. But nonetheless, the trial court gave exactly the instruction they wanted for a qualified privilege. They requested the instruction. They got it. The jury, in fact, found that they had actual malice and therefore found it was defamatory. Now they come in and they argue that, well, the court should have found that was absolutely privileged, but they never, ever ask it. In conclusion, this is a case in which our clients waited for 5.5 years and fought for 5.5 years to get to trial. To be vindicated. They did get vindicated at trial after 8 weeks of trial. That jury found by clear and convincing evidence that the American Chemical Society brought their lawsuit in bad faith. And they found by virtue of that, by their instruction, that they did it. The American Chemical Society did not have a legal basis to file it. The claim was without merit. And the American Chemical Society knew it was without merit when they filed it. Secondly, the jury found those two statements were false, defamatory. And by special interrogatory, they also found that the American Chemical Society knew those statements were false when they made them.
Did they relate the damages approximately to the cause of the defamation? Is there a relationship causally between the amount of the verdict and the defamation?
I believe there is, but there isn't any interrogatory that says that. There was substantial evidence with regard to the damages. There were experts for the individuals that testified with regard to the damages they suffered. There was an expert for the company that testified with regard to some $36 million worth of damage the company suffered. Each of the individuals had their, as I say, the expert, each of the individuals lost their reputations and their careers, and they were distinguished scientists. They were terribly damaged by this. The damage was overwhelming, and the evidence with regard to it was overwhelming, Your Honor. And the jury found this. After the trial, there was a year in post-trial motions. The judge found in a 73-page decision every objection the American Chemical Society had was either waived or wrong and upheld everything. Then there was another year at the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals in a unanimous decision found in a 45-page opinion all of the errors were without merit and upheld the verdict. It's now been over 9 years since the wrongs were inflicted on our clients. They have been terribly damaged. There was no error at the trial court. We ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Brune, you may have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very quick. What Mr. Briggs says is simply not true, and all I can do is direct the court to the record regarding the issues of waiver and other arguments that he make. With respect to ACS arguing repeatedly at trial, we're entitled to bring this lawsuit to the courts of Ohio because we had evidence to support it. That is at Supplement 134, 148, 173, and 174. I urge the court to go to the record, not to listen to statements of counsel. In terms of the instruction that ACS sought, which read, and I quote, that the jury would have to find malicious litigation, this is what ACS requested, quote, supplement page 290, go to the record, quote, that ACS filed its lawsuits in bad faith and without probable cause, meaning that ACS's lawsuit had no basis, and ACS knew that the litigation had no basis. That's the instruction we sought. The court refused to give it. Third, this issue about Norr Pennington and the First Amendment doesn't matter because the same standard exists as a matter of Ohio law. You don't need the First Amendment. Ohio law itself provides that these courts are open for litigants to come to this state and bring claims that have a legitimate basis. And neither court below found that ACS's claims did not have a legitimate basis. Forgive me for getting excited, but this, I can't imagine a more important case for this court or for this state. When you have a litigant who comes with a good faith basis, these claims should never have gone to the jury. Mr. Briggs is a wonderful lawyer. He makes a very impassioned argument, and the jury accepted the argument. These claims that ACS had no merit to its case, brought its claims in bad faith, should never have gone to the jury because the entire course of the trial showed we withstood a motion for summary judgment. We withstood a motion for a directed verdict. The actual jury verdict was not unanimous.
Briggs makes a great deal of issue out of the fact that malicious litigation does exist. We have a whole lot of amicus briefs that take a very different view of the law. I'm particularly interested in your view of the Supreme Court case he references in 1984. How do you read that case?
Well, Your Honor, the water management case, if you look at it, is an extremely short case that finds there's no basis to find malicious litigation in that case. So you can say that this court recognized the concept, but it found no basis to find malicious litigation. We did not, Mr. Briggs is right on one thing. At trial, ACS did not take the position that malicious litigation had not been recognized in Gehring and other cases because we didn't need to. Gehring makes clear that malicious litigation means bringing a claim that lacks warrant or proof. Our case had ample proof. This is not Gehring.
Well, the jury didn't agree with you on that. I mean, you started, your client started this fight. They sued this company.
We did, Your Honor. Absolutely.
And at the trial, I assume you put on a lot of evidence about why you thought the claims had merit.
We did, Your Honor. Absolutely.
And the jury concluded that it didn't have merit, and also concluded that this litigation was undertaken to break this company and these individuals. Isn't that the bottom line of their conclusions?
The jury found that, but our point, Your Honor, is there was no basis for that claim to go to the jury. The trial court, the Court of Appeals, and this court has an obligation to safeguard the ability of litigants to come to Ohio and bring claims so long as those claims are not a sham. If they're a sham, absolutely. You can impose liability for that.
Well, sham is not a term that appears in any, that's a pejorative term that you use.
Well, this court used in 2007 in Greer Burger. It held in Greer Burger that you have a right under the Ohio Constitution, under the U.S. Constitution, to bring claims unless those claims are a sham, which the court has defined to mean claims that lack probable cause, which is the exact instruction that ACS sought at trial. And what's an issue here, Justice, is the right of any litigant to bring claims, not just the American Chemical Society, not just Chemical Abstracts, a small litigant, a pro se litigant. They, too, are subjected to these kind of counterclaims for defamation because
Well, you're pretty good, too. You've just wrapped yourself in the flag here.
Well, Your Honor, we should all step back. This has been a hard-fought case for 9 years. We lost. We disagree that we lost with our claims. We're not taking that further. We're not challenging that. But what we do feel is wrong, simply wrong, is that we were found liable for $35 million in damages and attorney's fees for bringing our claims to the courts of Ohio. And we believe this court
actually,
should
aren't
look
the
at
damages
that.
For statements that were made about which the jury found were untrue.
Your Honor, those were
Isn't that the finding of the jury, that the statements that were made?
It's what the jury found. But again, we were entitled to judgment as a matter of law. There were two simple statements of lawyers. And I submit, if this court affirms, there is nothing that any lawyer in this state can say ever outside of the courtroom without subjecting his client to liability for defamation. There was no evidence of any damage from those statements. There was evidence of damage from the litigation, to be sure. Their contention was this litigation destroyed them, and we disputed that heavily at trial, but that's not before the court. But damage from litigation is very different from damage from these two simple statements of counsel. One, a statement to employees telling them not to talk about the case, and two, a single statement of Attorney Ferguson into a business article where it was clear these were the allegations in a lawsuit that had not been resolved. The defendants made extensive refutations. Under Rule 3.6B of the Attorney Rules of Professional Conduct, adopted by this court, these were statements an attorney under the rules may make because there's an important public interest, a First Amendment interest in attorney speech. The court's
Thank
been very
you,
gracious.
DeBrun.
I've gone way over time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Marshall, call a recess, please.